I, General Dimitri.
Dimitri Ratu laughed with his knights. This was his first command, handed to him by Prince Milwellus himself when Milwellus and Harcourt had departed. The mission seemed straightforward enough. The armored horsemen had a clear run to the hill and a clear trail up it. The fact that their enemies held the higher ground seemed inconsequential and had been to this point. For the Ethelbert defenders hadn't bows strong enough or spears heavy enough to inflict any real damage against the bronze plating, and hadn't the heart to continue the fight anyway, having been in retreat for days now. A few stubbornly kept their positions along the hillside, a few light spears had reached Dimitri's band, and an enemy occasionally climbed on rocks, sword or long spear in hand to block the way. But Palmaristown knights had ridden right through the diversions, ignoring the flimsy missiles and cutting low the peasants who wore no armor, who carried shields of ill-sewn leather, and who wielded weapons that bronze armor easily turned. In a gallop more often than a trot, Dimitri Ratu led his men up the side with the top, the goal, clearly in sight. Through the slit in his full helm, Dimitri hardly noticed the bare features on the shaved-headed man who appeared among the branches of a tree to his right, or his strange black clothing. The stranger disappeared into the thick boughs of the pine. The knights charged forward. The pine tree leaned over suddenly as if to grasp at them. It was the black-clothed stranger, holding its top branches and leaping to the side, his weight and momentum taking the tree down with him in his descent. He came across Dimitri's horse, both men disappearing in a swirl of green. And the knights gasped in unison as the tree swung back up, a flailing Dimitri affixed to it, the stranger sitting in Dimitri's saddle. The nearest knight leaped his horse ahead and readied his sword to slash at the attacker, but as if he had anticipated that very movement, the stranger slapped the mount and it reared on cue, bucking and double-kicking back. The stranger whirled Dimitri's mount around and produced a strange weapon, two black poles as long as a forearm, fastened end to end by an equally long length of dark leather. He held one of the poles and sent the other spinning as he brought his horse in line to pass by the next charging knight. As they passed, that curious twin-poled weapon snapped in against the back of the knight's bronze helm. The warrior from Bear turned to bring himself straight between the next two knights in line, and they adjusted their swords accordingly, thinking him mad and foolish despite his impressive display. Just before the three horses passed, the stranger leaped to stand upon his saddle and sent his leather-tied sticks into a whirling display. The two knights tried to ignore the diversionary movements, tried to focus on taking the warrior's legs out. The horses passed. The knight stabbed repeatedly, and the stranger from the Southland danced and leaped and worked his sticks into a spin, into a forward rolling action before him. He caught the flying pole tight under his right armpit suddenly, leaped the stabbing blades and landed sidelong. He back-kicked his left foot just as he released the trap pole from under his arm. The knight across the way fared little better, the back kick hitting him with a force he could not have anticipated and at just the right angle to lift him from his seat. The trailing knights, wanting no part of this southern creature, tried to turn aside, but other southerners appeared from the brush, leaping at them, kicking at them, stabbing them with long and thin poles. Only one managed to turn about completely, thinking to ride away to warn Prince Milwellus. He broke free and fought hard to balance his mount, refusing to relinquish the gallop even though he was in a steep descent. As the sounds of fighting receded behind him, he gradually relaxed and tried to ease his horse, but realized his folly when he noted movement within the brush to the side of the path. Another black-clothed warrior, a woman. She closed in a confusing blur, springing to her hands, then over to her feet, then up into the air in a dizzying spin. With stunning speed, she moved toward the trail, and the knight knew that he could not get past this somersaulting demoness. She came out of her curl as she descended, her muscles and momentum driving her extending legs out to crack against the knight's shoulder and neck. He didn't even realize that he was clear of his saddle and mount and flying free to the ground. Didn't even realize that the horse, this black-clothed demoness from Bear, was now astride, was his own. He hit the ground and all consciousness flew away.
Unworthy enemies.
Merwal Yana looked at the dead knights with disgust. Afwen Wee glanced around her, her gaze focusing on the one of her warriors who was writhing on the ground.
Not so unworthy.
It was not their worthiness, but the Iragu's own error. His leap fell short of his target.
Afwen Wee nodded, then indicated Merwal Yana's bloody nunchuck, the two poles tied with leather. With a grim nod in reply, the fierce half-Togai Rule, half-Baronese warrior walked over to his badly wounded companion and again sent his weapon into a spin, catching the flying pole under his arm. His muscles bulged and strained as he pulled against the hold, taking sure and merciful aim at the base of Tiragu's skull. Murwal Yana released the trapped nunchuck pole, and it snapped forward to devastating effect. Tiragu lay very still. Caught in the top branches of the swaying pine, Dimitri Retu rolled around just in time to see the execution of the wounded Baronese warrior. Somehow, that cold-blooded act, killing one of their own with such impunity, brought the first-time general to a new plane of terror. His fingers turned bloody as he desperately forced them under the rim of his helm and under the fine silk rope tied around his neck and hanging him from the trunk. All of his knights had been slain within moments, the black-clothed southerners moving about them with deadly precision. He dared hope that maybe they had forgotten him or believed him already dead. He closed his eyes, tightened his neck muscles as much as possible to fight the choke, and tried to go very still. The one who had caught him, the tall one with the shaved head and the strange weapon, moved to the low boughs right below him and pulled forth from them a silk rope, the other end of the one binding him. Dimitri understood just a moment before the southerner tugged it and the clever knot unwound and the young general crashed and bounced to the ground in the midst of his victorious enemies. Prince Milwellis and Harcourt did not receive the greeting they had anticipated when they at last came to King Yezelnik's encampment. Traveling through the tree-lined dells of the region, they had not seen the developments in the east along the shore until they crested the tall hill to stand beside Yezelnik and his commanders. Milwellis noted immediately that the king's eye was not turned to the southeast and the city of Ethelbert Dosentel, as he had expected, but to the northeast.
You are here.
What is this about?
Your army is being routed, and you are here.
Routed? They should be at the gates of Ethelbert by now.
They've lost a league of ground.
Did Ethelbert come at them with all his force? Even then, we should have routed.
Our scouts saw no sizable force moving from the city gates. Are you certain that your men simply did not retreat?
No.
More scouts went out from Yezelnik's camp soon after, and more came in with reports of dead Palmaristan soldiers and the main force in fast retreat. Milwellis wanted to ride to them, but Yezelnik would hear none of that.
He's more interested in making sure that he's surrounded by strength.
Harcourt and Milwellis wandered about the encampment. Milwellis looked at him incredulously, but finally nodded, glad again that his father had thought to put this candid and seasoned warrior beside him. Long after the sun had set, the riddle of the retreat was finally solved, for some of Yezelnik's scouts returned with a pair of Milwellis' men, both wounded.
Demons! They walked invisible through the trees.
Demons?
Not demons. Men, sure enough. And women. Southerners. Beasts of bear. But they're demons when they're fighting. None should doubt.
A sizable force?
A handful.
Backed by?
Just a handful. And our knights are all gone.
Gone?
Dimitri Retu?
All gone. They went up the hill, and the demons came down.
You saw them? Up close?
Yes.
What weapons did they wield?
Strange ones for some. Swords for a couple, and one used a half sword.
Yezelnik looked at him curiously.
Broken, maybe, but half a sword and with a jagged tip.
King Yezelnik looked as if he might topple over. He turned to regard his commanders in Milwellis.
What is it, my king?
The assassins who killed King Delaval. Where are these enemies now?
The two looked to each other and shrugged, then turned back sheepishly to the king.
The fighting stopped, my king. The enemy disappeared into the hills, likely exhausted.
King Yezelnik began glancing around, eyes darting nervously from shadow to distant shadow.
And so the war continues. Ethelbert has diverted disaster. We cannot push him into the sea.
One of Yezelnik's commanders spoke up.
A full attack, north and west, my king. A few assassins will not stop the prepared lines of our army.
No. We should not remain here, not now. Ethelbert has turned the tide against us. He is wounded and battered and will not come forth. And so we can go, quickly.
Go?
To lands more familiar and more to our liking. Yes, that is the course. We will retreat to Pride Town or to Delaval.
Delaval was no defense against the assassins before.
But we will be more vigilant. We will back away and parley. Yes, parley. Perhaps Ethelbert will stay in his city and we can go. We can take the rest of Hans. Yes, yes, I must consider our course. But not here, not now. Break the camp and be ready to depart.
A dejected Master Riandu walked into the small village of Eskald 3 days north of Pride Town. An inconsequential place, Eskald had no chapel and only a tiny keep, barely more than a stone house atop a cleared hill to serve as the castle for its laird. As he passed along the main road through the bulk of the houses, the monk saw that the people were all astir, and he knew that their agitation was not on account of his arrival. He turned a questioning gaze to one young woman whose response was a chin nod toward the laird's house on the hill. Following that look, Riandu noted a familiar sight, the chariot of Bonagran. Riandu moved up the hill. He didn't even have to tell the lone guard to announce him to the laird, for Bonagran was coming out the door even as he approached. Riandu thought that a good thing, for the laird of Eskald, a man of great mouth and little repute, by the name of Macwak Bolne, was one of the most insufferable and self-absorbed men Riandu had ever met. A visit with him would involve hours of time listening to the man recount the exploits of his long-lost youth, how he rode with Pride in the Powery War, which wasn't true, though the pompous laird had probably claimed as much to Bonagran, who had led Pride's forces in that very conflict, and how Laird Ethelbert had not come to attack Eskald out of respect, nay fear, of the heroic Macwak Bolne. The look on Bonagran's face, like it was locked in a permanent sigh, told Riandu that his friend had not been spared the recounting.
Has he saved the world this day?
Twice, methinks.
I did not expect to see you here. I have been told that the fighting has moved south.
All the way to Ethelbert Docental.
And you are north of Pride, on the hunt for the highwayman.
I have been tasked with that. King Nislnik has determined that his finest general should don the mantle of bounty hunter, and this at a time when his greatest enemy might soon be pushed into the sea. What do you know?
His finest general? I am just unused to such aggrandizement from you. About you.
Be at ease, monk. Else I will show you the truth of the claim. What news of our masked friend?
He was seen on the road to Chapel Abel. He passed through Palmaris Town, but he did not arrive at Chapel Abel.
One of the villages to the west of that place, then? Or did he pass to the east by the chapel and move along Philidon Bay? If that is the case, then he is likely dead. Milwellis offered little quarter to the people of the Holdings who joined with Laird Ethelbert's cause.
The whispers claim that our friend Branson went to Vanguard before the winter.
The whispers are wrong, then.
Or that is not Branson's sword. He went to Vanguard before the winter, they claim, and claim with some confidence. It is rumored that Branson joined with Dame Gwydra in her struggles against the Samhaists. And we both know that Branson has no love for that cult.
Bonagran suddenly appeared more tired, and he rubbed his face.
You believe that King Yeselnik will send you there in pursuit?
If the highwayman is there, then he will, without a doubt. He wants our friend dead. More than anything in the world, he wants the highwayman slaughtered.
If Branson is in Vanguard, then he couldn't have killed King Delaval. The distance is too great, and the seas and land impassable through the winter months. Surely King Yeselnik will understand this, and will rethink the best course for his finest general.
It would hardly matter. Yeselnik's hatred of this one was strong before the evidence of the highwayman's complicity in King Delaval's death. Before King Delaval had even been killed. Twice now has our little friend robbed him, and both times shaming him in front of his his wife. To a man like Yeselnik, that is a more egregious crime than murder.
A vain man like Yeselnik, you mean, with an insufferable wife.
Your words, not mine. And words that will get you slain.
King Yeselnik has invited great strife within the Order of Abel. Father Arthur Levin cannot do what he has demanded of us.
Bonagran looked at him curiously.
To free all prisoners loyal to Delaval who were sent to the keeping of the brothers, and to kill all loyal to Ethelbert.
Bonagran's face screwed up for a moment, but then he just shook his head as if hardly surprised, as if nothing Yeselnik did would ever surprise him.
He will send you to Vanguard.
To the edge of the world and over it. Our young king is not in good humor. He is wounded by the death of Delaval.
And he is afraid.
And he is frustrated by Ethelbert's stubbornness and fight. Yeselnik is focusing all of those emotions on the highwayman now, as if he is the source of all the prince's ills. He will not rest until he has the head of Branson Garibond.
So you are certain and will head straight away to Vanguard?
No, and I hope that I am wrong.
You are returning to Pride, then?
Though I fear my rest will be short.
And you will offer a brother a ride in your fine chariot?
No, but I am sure that Riandu is so forward that he will take one anyway.
They made Pride Town the next day, just as the first advance scouts of King Yeselnik's army were arriving with news of the stinging reversal at the gates of the southern city. The news that the war was still on in full, that Ethelbert had stayed the seemingly inevitable conclusion, was not as unwelcome to Bonnegran as it was to Riandu. At least for Bonnegran, it offered some hope that he wouldn't be sent to the cold north of Vanguard.
They'll not be any quicker because of your pacing.
Sitting beside Kay Dale on the long bench in the antechamber, Callan smiled.
He's blazing a fine trail across Father Otto Levin's rug.
Brentson did stop his pacing momentarily to regard the women. They had been waiting in the antechamber to Father Otto Levin's audience hall for more than an hour, expecting to be called in to speak on behalf of Cormac, who was in front of the court of Chapel Abel, facing the impassioned appeals of Father de Gilb.
He's got Father Promotion speaking for him, and Brother Giovno even, and Dame Guidra herself. She had to preside neutrally over the court in Vanguard, but here she makes no secret of her support for Cormac and Milcaela.
I've seen too much of the likes of men akin to Father de Gilb.
The door swung open and Father de Gilb stormed from the audience chamber. Brother Giovno came close behind the large and angry man and tried to speak. De Gilb turned suddenly.
Do not follow me, brother, else I will be spending my next days inside Chapel Abel's dungeon.
At first, Giovno looked as if he had been slapped, but as De Gilb stormed from the antechamber, the monk just shrugged at the three witnesses.
I'm guessing it went well for Cormac and Milcaela.
Beyond anything I could have hoped.
Arm in arm, Cormac and Milcaela moved from the audience hall.
Father Otto Levin would like to sanction our marriage formally.
Then you are forgiven.
And offered a return to the order.
You'll not go back.
I've made no decision, but it was good to be asked.
Hurry along, then.
They would see you now.
Branson and the two women exchanged surprised looks, for they thought they had been brought here solely to speak on Cormac's behalf, which was apparently no longer required. With a shake of Cormac's hand and a hug for Milcaela, Branson entered the audience hall, his wife and Callan close behind.
I had thought to be speaking for Cormac.
Branson walked to the center of the carpet. He faced a long table behind which sat Father Otto Levin and Father Primusion, Dame Guidra, several other monks Branson did not know, and, surprisingly, Jameson Sequin and Dawson McKeague.
It was not necessary. Cormac's character was well presented and represented. We have heard news of you, young man. Information regarding the highwayman.
It's good to be famous.
You are hunted, friend. Accused of a crime against the throne of Hans.
I did not know that Hans had a throne. Just a bunch of petty lords with petty concerns and not a care at all for who they destroy to see their desires fulfilled.
Father Otto Levin smiled and glanced at Dame Quadra.
A notable exception to the rule.
You are accused of a serious crime, highwayman.
That I robbed that idiot Yeselnik in Delavore City? Of that, I admit my guilt. I robbed him as well in Pride, right after I rescued him from certain death at the hands of marauding Powdries. I have already admitted my past deeds, though in my heart I fear that my biggest error was saving Yeselnik from the dwarves. Dame Gwydra's writ of passage was offered with knowledge of those thefts.
Laird Delaval, King Delaval, was murdered in the same tower where you robbed his nephew.
At the same time?
No, recently.
While you were in Vanguard.
I'm sorry?
King Yeselnik.
King?
He proclaims himself King of Hans as the rightful heir of Delaval, who similarly demanded the title. He believes you complicit in the death of his uncle, King Delaval.
My arms are not that long. I did not know the man. Why would I want to kill him? And if I hadn't killed the loathsome Yeselnik, then why would I go out of my way to kill his uncle?
Your contempt for the new King of Hans is noted, as is your proclamation of innocence.
I have been in Vanguard throughout the winter, with Dawson McKeague, and with Brother John and Cormac after him. How could I have been involved in a murder in Delavore City?
We are not your judge and jury. We know that you could not have been involved in this tragedy, but King Yeselnik will not be so easily swayed, I fear, given all that I have heard of him.
What does that mean?
It means that my writ of passage to you may not be enough. It means that you and Kay Dale and Callan should remain here, or even sail back to Vanguard with me when I go.
Branson stared at her hard, angrily, suspiciously.
I honor the writ of passage and will not detain you in any manner. You and your family are welcome at Chapel Abel.
Branson never blinked and never stopped staring at Guidra.
Yeselnik claims that Branson, the highwayman, killed Delaval.
We know otherwise.
We do, but he does not, nor do the lairds who do his bidding. It was Master Eandu of Chapel Pride who delivered the news only right before we arrived here.
Branson's face brightened at the name.
You know him?
Quite well, I am told. And if it means anything to you, young man, I think that Master Eandu doubted in his heart the claims against you.
We will work to clear your reputation.
If Yeselnik is king of Haunts, then your work will be in vain. Know that he will always hate the highwayman, as much because of his own failings as a husband and a man as because of the robberies. His wife was rather taken by a man who would fight against enemies instead of sniveling inside the coach. If Yeselnik is your king, then as much as I would have thought it impossible, my estimation of the nobility and leadership of Haunts Holdings has sunk even lower. He is a fool and a fop, a vain and preposterous coward.
Enough, Branson. We will work to clear your name, as Dame Gwydra insisted. We are interested in justice.
That is not my experience with Laird or brother.
Enough. We ask that you remain here for your own sake and the sake of your family until we can clear away all this confusion.
Or we will be sailed to Bear.
Give us time.
And now you will excuse us, for we have other matters to discuss.
No. I wish Branson to sit with me as we discuss the situation.
Father Artolevan looked at her with surprise and something less than enthusiasm.
He has earned it.
She turned to Branson and motioned to an empty chair at the end of the table.
He may be quite important as this goes forward. The highwayman is not unknown in Haunts and not unloved by many of the people we seek to serve.
Would the two of you please excuse us then?
Kaydale moved up and kissed Branson on the cheek and squeezed his hand, then took her leave with her mother. For all his bravado, Branson felt quite unsure of himself as he moved to take the seat between Jameson and Gwydra. He sat quietly as the group began discussing Yeselnik's new edict regarding disposition of prisoners. He wasn't surprised by the foppish, self-proclaimed king's lack of simple morality, of course.
And you will react how?
We must refuse this man who calls himself King of Haunts.
And I will support you, of course. Let us hope that King Yeselnik will listen to reason on this matter.
He won't. He is stubborn and vain beyond description.
In that case, we will be faced with more difficult decisions still. But we will forge our way through the obstacles as they are presented to us. For now, King Yeselnik awaits our further word on his edict regarding the prisoners. He will not be pleased, but we must follow what is right and just in concert with the teachings of Blessed Abel.
For some reason, the decision and declaration of the father of the Order of Abel unsettled Branson even more than the unsurprising news of Yeselnik's continuing and escalating stupidity. He left the meeting much later on, his thoughts spinning both for himself and his family, and their place in the world, and for the larger issues of Haunts and this new king who could be nothing more than a catastrophe. The couriers went from Chapel Abel soon after the meeting had adjourned.
How do you fare with the new order of the world?
Branson turned and greeted Cormac as he approached.
I am not surprised by the actions of Yeselnik, to be sure. I have encountered the man a couple of times in the last months. Neither meeting has left me impressed with his wit or his wisdom.
I mean regarding Branson. You expected to walk Haunts a free man.
And so I shall.
By your stubbornness and your sword? Is there not the matter of your wife and her mother to consider?
Dame Gwydra
is powerless against Yeselnik at this time. Her writ of passage will not be honored for a man believed to be the killer of King Delaval. And honestly, it would be foolhardy to not rescind the order. If you go and present that document, then she too will be complicit in the killing of King Delaval.
I had nothing to do with that. I was beside you, was I not?
And you believe that matters?
No.
So what will you do?
I don't know. Dawson McKeague has pledged to sail me wherever I wish to go. Perhaps to Bear.
Jacintha?
Branson furrowed his brow in puzzlement.
The principal city of the Desert Kingdom. Just south of the city of Ethelbert Dos Entel, around the Belt and Buckle Mountains, whose rocky spurs jut into the Mirianic as if God himself did not want the men of Haunts and of Bear to mingle.
Jacintha, then?
It is a strange place with strange ways.
A fine choice you offer.
Father Artolevan will not expel you or your family, nor will he turn you over to Yeselnik's soldiers if they come.
So, you offer me imprisonment in a chapel of faith I do not hold true, or a journey to a strange and dangerous place. Shall I thank you for creating great contentment within my tumultuous soul?
Vanguard.
Again, he drew a puzzled look from Branson.
It is a wondrous place, full of freedom and personal responsibility. It is the perfect location for one who wants no part of the politics and intrigue of Hans or of Bear, I am told.
Will Cormac be there?
And Michaela. Dame Gwydra speaks of dividing up her vast holding into smaller duchies, and has hinted that she will offer one to me.
And you would like the highwayman as a subject?
Or as a neighboring duke.
I thought you just said...
I did, and I hold to it. I only mean that if you wished more for yourself and Kaydale, then you will find an ally in Dame Gwydra. Do not doubt. She expressed deep gratitude to me when we spoke quietly about a possible appointment, though she counseled me to consider Father Otto Leven's offer to return to the Order of Blessed Abel.
And will you?
I would be a liar if I said that I was not intrigued. Great healing might be accomplished between the Order of Abel and Milkayla's shaman brethren, and between Vanguard and the Alpinadoran tribes. Father de Gilb did great damage on Chapel Isle. Our battle with the many tribes of Mithranadun...
And de Gilb's refusal to join in the common cause against ancient Bodden.
Perhaps I can do some good.
As a monk or as a duke?
That is the question, is it not?
Why not as both?
It was Cormac's turn to wear an expression of surprise, which shifted to one of intrigue.
But what for you?
I wish at some point to travel to Bear. I must. But Hans is my home, and I do not count that lightly. And there is another matter. Hans is Callan and Kaydale's home as well, and they should be free to remain here and wait for my return, particularly Callan, who long ago grew weary of the road.
You would trust Yezelnik to honor the writ of passage for them and not imprison them to use against you?
Of course I would not.
And so we are back where we began.
I will go to Pride Town to test Dame Gwydra's writ of passage. And if it is not to be honored, I will do what I need to clear my name and to demand the commute of any claims made against me. I served honorably under a bargain from a Hansler lady. I expect, when the truth is known that I could not have participated in the murder of King Delavore, that my covenant with Dame Gwydra will be respected.
You will march south and demand all that?
I will journey south more quietly and learn and adapt. I am the highwayman, have you not heard? And the highwayman has many friends in Pride Town.
And many enemies.
That is what I intend to learn.
She knew. The truth permeated Branson's thoughts as he navigated the corridors and courtyards of the sprawling complex of Chapel Abel. He had tried to hide his decision from Kaydale for the time being, out of cowardice, he admitted to himself. But she had seen through him, and his tenuous and halting answers, stuttered even though he had the soulstone firmly tied against his forehead, had led Kaydale to more incisive and determined questioning. By the time Branson had managed an appropriate dodge to the larger question of his intentions, Kaydale had already confirmed her suspicions. She knew, Branson believed, that he was planning to leave her once again, despite his promises to her in Vanguard. The look on her face as he had walked out of their room that morning, a combination of resoluteness and sadness, had nearly made him change his mind, had nearly turned him toward a different course, perhaps back to Vanguard with Cormac. But now, as he walked the ways of the great chapel complex, as he heard the familiar dialect of the many men hard at work, Branson understood that he must go at once to Pride Town, to confront Riandu with the hard evidence, the letters of proof from many reliable affiants. He had to believe that somewhere, somehow, even in the holdings of Yezelnik, the truth would ultimately win out, and he would be exonerated, and that Gwydra's writ of passage for him and for his family would be honored. If there was any justice in the world, this course would be the correct one to walk. But Kaydale knew. His inner tumult slowed his steps as he neared Father Artolivan's chambers, and he slowed further as he came to hear loud arguing from behind the solid oaken door. Right before the door, the words became clear, as did the voices of Fathers Artolivan, Primujan, and de Gilb.
You would have me kill them? These men who were given to Chapel Abel and put under our care on condition that for them the war had ended?
We must choose between Yezelnik, who will win, and Ethelbert, who hides in the south. The greater movement of the kingdom is beyond our control. Delaval won and gave his winnings to Yezelnik, and thus Yezelnik is the king of Hans.
That simply?
Yes, unless you know of some great army stirring to oppose him.
His victory over Laird Ethelbert seems assured by last reports.
Then we are to recognize Yezelnik as King of Hants. What other choices before us?
Recognition with precondition, perhaps. We can force King Yezelnik's hand on this and other matters, promise our fealty, but only to a goodly king.
You think yourself the king?
Father de Gilb!
If Yezelnik is the King of Hants, then the decisions are his to make. We cannot say that we agree here and disagree and therefore will not abide there. Is he the King of Hants or is he not? And if he is, then we are bound to honor...
I will not murder unarmed prisoners.
Then you should not have involved our order in this secular business of war.
Father!
It is true. We heal the wounded for both sides. That is a good thing. And all the chapels agreed. But then you agreed to turn our most holy and important monastery into a prison?
A prison that sent men to the aid of Vanguard.
That matters not at all. Father Artelevan took it upon himself to involve the order in matters where it did not belong. You cannot make such a stand and then decide at a later date that you don't like the outcome.
We retained our neutrality.
Until one side or the other gained the advantage. For surely, had Ethelbert won the field, his demands upon you would be equally harsh and distasteful.
I do not believe that, nor do I believe that Laird Delaval would be possessed of such cruelty.
Then you are a fool, and you have softened to the point where your leadership is a danger to the Order of Abel.
Father!
I demand a council of fathers.
Denied.
You cannot deny it alone.
Denied. 2-1, then. Find more fathers of similar humor to yours and make your request at a later date.
And until then, know that I will not execute the men of Laird Ethelbert, taken under honor and sent here under promise of my protection.
And the men of Laird Delaval?
Are here as agreed. King Yezelnik will not have them turned free to serve his cause until the war with Laird Ethelbert is settled.
Our order has gone soft. As with Cormac, who betrayed us.
This was about Cormac all along.
It is about a church that forgets the harsh lessons of the wider world. A church so steeped in false hope and idealism and tolerance that it ensures its own inevitable collapse.
If I gave you a sword and the order from King Yezelnik, would you kill the prisoners with your own hand, Father de Gilb?
Yes, because I look beyond the lives of a few and the immediacy of our current situation. War is cruel. And need be, to end it swiftly and to make the mere thought of it cause men to piss in their britches.
You sound like a Samhaste.
You are dangerously wrong in your decisions, Father Artelevan.
If you believe that, then find enough support among the brethren to force your counsel. Truly, you tire me. I sent a man of spirit and hopefulness to Alpinador those years ago. A mission that I thought de Gilb might accomplish in bridging the differences between our ways and those of our northern brothers. This man who returns to me these years later hardly resembles the one I knew.
Because I am wiser.
Because you are hardened and stubborn.
Brunson managed to jump back a couple of steps and tried to appear as if he was just arriving when the door was flung open and the large monk rushed out. With only a cursory glance at Branson and a dismissive shake of his head, de Gilb stormed away.
Greetings, Branson Garibond. To what do I owe the pleasure of your visit so early in the day?
Your pardon, Father. I have made a decision and wish to inform you first of all.
A decision? I did not know that you were faced with a question.
Concerning my destination and my place in the world, I will take my leave of Chapel Abel this day. With Dame Guidra's writ of passage in hand, I will go to clear the name of the highwayman.
King Yezelnik will kill you.
Yezelnik seems not to be a reasonable man.
I know him well, and I do not disagree regarding his temperament. But there are others I know to be reasonable and just.
You will build support for your cause?
That is my hope. And I hope that Father Artelevan will lend that support.
To the side, Father Primujan shifted uncomfortably, as did Brother Pinauer, who had walked into the room behind Branson.
I will speak truthfully to that which I know, of course. What more would you have from me?
A second writ of passage.
You cannot ask this of Chapel Abel. We are in difficult straits with King Yezelnik as it is.
And with some in your own ranks.
You appreciate the difficulty I have in openly defying King Yezelnik at this time on this issue?
I do.
I cannot offer you any imprimatur that would serve you against the king's men. But perhaps I can fashion some writ to add my voice to Dame Guaidra's, some imprimatur to ensure those favorable to your cause that I witnessed Dame Guaidra's testimony on your behalf and found it credible.
That would be most helpful.
Your wife and her mother are welcome to remain here at Chapel of Bell. I trust you will not be bringing them along on your undoubtedly perilous journey.
I have to go. If Yezelnik is to be King of Haunts, then I have to clear my name and regain the freedom I earned from Dame Guaidra.
King Yezelnik is a stubborn one. He will not be easily swayed.
Branson, knowing Yezelnik better than any in the room, nodded, but he smiled as he did, and in a flash drew out his magnificent sword.
For the third time, I will put him at the tip of my sword. I suspect that while his eyes are seeing the sharpened edge, his heart will see the truth of Branson.
Brilliant. I only hope that Hans will forgive you for stopping short your deadly blade.
Father!
I would like for you to stay, Highwayman, though I know you cannot. Return to me if you find the time.
To retrieve my family, of course.
Oh, and to sit with me. I have only heard small stretches of the history of Branson Garibond and this hero known as the Highwayman, and of the Stork. I would like to hear the whole story.
Ask Kaydale. She can tell it as well as I, since she was there for most of my steps. Even the awkward ones of the Stork that as often as not left me face down in the mud.
Sometimes in the mud of Chapel Pride, with buckets in hand.
Branson looked at him surprised that he knew so much.
Small stretches of your history. And there is one more thing.
Father Arthur Levin reached up and touched the front of Branson's black bandana, tapping right atop the soul stone hidden beneath it, and secured to his forehead. He turned to Pinauer and pointed to the desk, and then pointed more emphatically when the younger monk hesitated.
I have had a long discussion with Brother Cormac.
Pinauer walked over with a small decorated box. With obvious reverence, he handed it to Arthur Levin, who held it before Branson as he slowly opened its hinged lid. Branson's eyes widened as he stared at the contents. A small star-shaped brooch, no more than a fingertip across at its widest point, centered with a soul stone and containing in its five tips other stones of various colors. He recognized the ruby at its top point, flanked left and right by malachite and a particular type of agate known as cat's eye. The striated stone set in the bottom left point he thought to be serpentine, and the other he knew as quartz, but a cloudy variety whose properties Branson did not know.
This was made for Laird Delaval's grandfather, ironically, in the early days of the Order of Abel. To Father Abel's surprise, the Laird refused it, despite its obvious powers, since we were not as accepted back in those days, when the Samhastes dominated Hans.
He lifted the brooch and slowly turned it so that Branson could better see its wondrous craftsmanship, including small hooks and pins on the backing.
It is fashioned of silverel, the same metal as your unusual sword, and edged in graphite, the Stone of Lightning.
What does it do?
Separately, the gems are each possessed of their own blessing.
They are all enchanted.
It is a fine item. It was crafted to be sewn to the chest, above the heart. But perhaps on your forehead.
To the cloth?
To the skin itself.
Branson's eyes widened in surprise and a bit of trepidation. He calmed quickly as he remembered the fight on the road with Dame Guaidra's raiders when his bandana and stone had been knocked away and he had been helpless against the troll enemies.
I have spoken about you at length with Brother John as well.
Women in Bear wear gemstones in such a manner. They call it tika, and it is considered quite beautiful.
And those are simple and mundane jewels. Magically speaking, I mean. You will find these stones useful in other ways.
He handed the brooch to Branson, who slowly lifted it to his forehead with one hand, slipping free the other soul stone as he slid the new one in place. He closed his eyes and fell within the flux of energy offered by the gems. His Kichi Kree, his line of life energy, remained straight and strong as with the other soul stone. And other possibilities flitted through his thoughts, a jumble at first, but gradually sorting themselves out. Possibilities.
You would give this to me?
An extraordinary gift for an extraordinary man. It does my old heart good to see that brooch so long in the coffer upon your forehead.
And it looks quite good.
Branson left Artolevan's quarters with his bandana in his hand, and he walked with the sure gait of the highwayman, not the awkward stumble of the stork.
You hate me.
Branson spoke after a long and uncomfortable pause. Kaydale looked up at him across the room.
For a hero, you're sure for saying some stupid things. She's no more for hating you than you are for her, and you should be able to see that clear enough in her eyes by now.
Of course I don't, but I am afraid, and I'll miss you dearly, as I did in Vanguard those weeks you were gone from me.
I know, but I have to do this. My name is clear, as Dame Guaidra agreed.
We'd be free enough in Vanguard.
I've spent most of my life trying to figure out how and where I belong. Haunts is our home. Pride is our home. Even if we choose not to live there, we should be able to return at our leisure.
When we left, you left a dead laird behind.
But even that is forgiven by Guaidra.
By Bonagran?
I don't know, but I will find out. I want Brother Riandu, Master Riandu, I mean, to know the truth of it. To know that I am no criminal, and that his order, at the very highest level, has deigned to honor and accept me.
Because of your life at Chapel Pride. Because of the way Riandu and the others treated you.
Branson couldn't deny the obvious truth of Kaydale's observations, so he just slid back from her a bit and shrugged helplessly.
If Bonagran or Yezelnik catches and kills you, I'll never forgive you.
Then you don't hate me.
I know you have to do this. I only wish I could go with you.
Not now.
I know.
Here, you hero.
Kellen took a couple of steps toward Branson and tossed him his bandana, which she had been sewing. He caught it and examined it, then slipped the now thin eye mask on.
The dashing highwayman.
They know who I am. And now I need not hold a gemstone in place. There is no point to the disguise.
Yes, there is.
The common folk of Pride know the highwayman more than they know Branson Garibond. Your reputation is your advantage against Bonagran.
Branson's step was sure-footed, but much less animated as he walked out of Chapel Abel that afternoon. He was confident that his course was correct, and that he had justice on his side. But the thought of leaving Kaydale for an extended period yet again, even though he expected to be gone from Chapel Abel for no more than a couple of weeks, wounded him. He glanced back to see Dame Guaidra and Dawson McKeague watching him from the wall, Guaidra nodding her approval. Kaydale was not there, though, and Branson was glad of it, for had his beautiful wife been watching, he would have turned and rushed back to her.
You've got a longer road before you if every step forward is taken with half a step backwards.
Branson relaxed when the speaker, Jamestown Sequin, walked out of the shadows. Branson glanced all around and back the way he had come, back toward Chapel Abel, which was long out of sight by then.
What are you doing out here?
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've walked the ways of Haunts.
Vanguard is part of Haunts.
Haven't been here in more years than you've been alive. Thought this would be as good a time as any to reacquaint myself.
Heading where?
You know that better than myself.
I am going to Pride Town. Dame Guaidra believes I need a bodyguard.
Doubt that, since she sent you against Bodden.
But she asked you to come with me on my journey.
Was my idea.
One she thought wise.
I'll give you that much. But I do want to walk the ways of Haunts again. And I know more than a bit about staying out of sight and out of notice. I think you'll find that helpful.
I am no novice.
Could have fooled me the way you're dancing down the path. And if I was one of Yezelnik's men with a bow, you'd be lying dead in that brush.
Branson just stared at him hard.
Oh, but quit pretending. You know I'll be helpful. You know I won't slow you down. And you know you don't want to walk alone. You also know, but you're too proud to admit it, that you might learn from my long experiences. Sure, you know how to fight. You're as good as any I've ever seen, and I've seen many. But you could learn a few things about when to fight and where to fight from, I'm thinking.
Branson didn't reply, but his visage did soften.
You know you don't want to go alone.
Branson couldn't resist that smile and returned it.
Now, good thing we got a long road ahead of us, because you got a lot to learn, and I got a lot to teach you.
Young brother Pontius ran along the road to the west, his precious cargo, the edict from Father Arthur Levin, set in a scroll case and slung over one shoulder. He hoped to reach Palmaris Town, his goal, before sunset. Suddenly, he felt very vulnerable there alone on the road with so important a letter, and those feelings only increased when he heard the clip-clop of a horse and the rattle of coach wheels behind him. Pontius veered off the side of the road, moving down into a gully behind some brush, where he crouched and looked back the way he had come. He relaxed when he saw the horse, adorned in a bridle that showed the evergreen symbol of Chapel of Bell and his beloved order. He knew this horse and recognized the small wagon it pulled. He scrambled back up to the road, waving for his brethren. He reached up, but froze in place when the coach's door flew open and Father de Gilb leaned out, lifting his head over it and scowling fiercely at the young courier.
Father!
I do not recall hearing an invitation for you to ride with us.
No, Father. I assumed that the coach from Chapel of Bell would afford a brother a seat.
You deliver Father Artelevan's message to Laird Panlamaris?
That is my duty, yes, Father.
You know Laird Panlamaris, boy?
No, Father. I met his son when Prince Milwellis passed through Chapel of Bell.
And your impressions of the young man?
I didn't know him well.
The large and imposing father then motioned toward the bench seat beside Josal.
Do join us. I wish to see the look on Laird Panlamaris's face when you deliver to him the notification of Father Artelevan's treason.
Brother Pontius swallowed hard and never stopped staring at Father de Gilb as he made his way onto the seat beside Josal. Behind them, the door closed, and Josal urged his horse back into motion. They made the great port city by mid-afternoon. Ordering Josal to stay with the coach, de Gilb escorted Pontius into the castle and, again, this time as a diplomat and not a navigator, had them at their destination in short order, standing before the throne of old Laird Panlamaris.
De Gilb, young fool, is that really you?
Panlamaris was a grizzled old man, still thick and strong, and carrying the scars of 1,000 fights.
Not so young anymore, Laird.
Aren't you supposed to be an Alpinador converting barbarians to the light in the stones?
Too stubborn and stupid a lot for that. I could not convince them, so I killed a bunch instead.
Your order is better for it. I've met a few Alpinadorians in my sailing days. Not one worthy of civility. Fierce warriors, though, huh? So, I count those among my finest kills. So, what brings young de Gilb to my humble city?
Not so young, though I wish I were. And there is little humble about the grandeur that is Palmaris Town. I do believe that your fine city has grown as powerful as I have grown old.
The flagon of mead for that man.
An attendant scurried from the room.
And we have prospered under the fine friendship of King Delaval. May the old ones see fit to seat him at their table.
Aye.
And you must know, de Gilb, that everyone in the world seems young to me.
Father Artelevan?
No, perhaps not that one. The gods don't want him, so they make us keep him. Your pardon, brother. I do not suffer that one well.
Your son would agree.
The rebuff of Milwellis will be remembered the next time Father Artelevan calls upon Palmaris Town's fleet for transport or supply or defense.
Smiling all the wider, Father de Gilb reached around Brother Pontius and removed the slung scroll case.
I expect none of those to happen anytime soon.
He handed it to Panlamaris. An attendant rushed up and took the case, popping off one end and rolling wide the scroll. Panlamaris read it quickly. The man sat stone-faced. Another attendant came in with Father de Gilb's flagon of mead, and the monk took his first swallow.
You would drink with me after delivering this?
Brother Pontius took a step away from the throne.
I? Not I. Brother Pontius here delivered the note. Would that it had never been penned, but Father Artelevan would not heed my advice.
You know what it says?
Yes.
Pan Lemaris fixed a withering gaze on poor Pontius.
He is a courier and nothing more.
Then get out of my chambers!
Bowing with every backward step, mouthing words though no sound came forth, Brother Pontius executed a graceless departure.
Has Otto even gone mad then?
DeGilb shrugged.
Yezelnik wins, has won! Ethelbert is pushed to the sea and will not break out. More of Hans's holdings pledge fealty to Yezelnik daily.
DeGilb nodded.
This is treason.
It is far worse than you think. They harbor not only the prisoners from Ethelbert's army, they hold in chains not only the men loyal to King Yezelnik, but there is another in their chapel who is much sought after. They harbor the highwayman.
He murdered King Delaval.
Dame Guaidra has provided him with a writ of passage, forgiving all crimes.
She forgives the murder of the king? How many brothers are at Chapel La Belle?
Less than 300.
How many prisoners of each side?
I know not the exact count. A couple of hundred of Yezelnik's men, perhaps twice that of Ethelbert's.
Would that my son were returned from the Myrianic coast. He has many of my finest commanders and warriors with him. Well then. It wouldn't do for Mil Welis to have all the fun, would it?
What will you do?
Since Yezelnik's decree, I've got more men free of duties, what with fewer prisoners to watch. A couple hundred monks, a few hundred others.
Dame Guaidra is there with four ships of men.
Skinners and drunkards, no doubt. She won't follow the course of Otto Levin. She's nobody's fool, from all I've heard. She'll get on her boat and go home. This isn't her fight.
You've got to know what they see. If you were up on that rock, where would you be looking? What movements would catch your eye?
Branson squinted in concentration as he followed Jameson's pointing hand.
We're over there by the stream in that stand of oaks.
There are a million places to hide, and surely there is no path invisible to all of them.
Am I telling you anything different than those who taught you to fight? Is there any perfect defense or a swing that can't be parried?
Measure your enemy. So where would enemies most likely hide and wait? What vantage points are most likely, and how to avoid them?
You couldn't have admitted that an hour ago and saved me my talking. It's a pretty wife you left behind.
It's been a long road.
Oh, but we've just left.
Not from Chapel of Bell. For so many years, my life moved in a slow and straight line. Everything around me was solid as stone, even when I wasn't.
When you were this stork fellow, you mean?
Even as I begin to find those moments of escape from the stork, there were so many constants. It was as if the world was there, one place known to me, and I could play with it as it amused me. But now, there is so much tumult, so many things changing.
Now, you've got others depending on you. That's the only real difference. I've seen it happen 1,000 times. You got your wife now with child, and a mother all needing you. So you're more careful with every step and smiling less because you got something to lose. For the first time in your life, you've got a lot to lose.
Thank you for pointing that out.
And you're making the biggest mistake of all. You got more to lose because all the world, all your world, is better. But you're smiling less. You're letting those bad maybes bury the good that is.
What?
Lighten your step. I spent many hours with Callan on the boat. She told me of a masked man who challenged the Laird of Pride and defeated him. She told me of a masked man who leaped from a Samhain bonfire to slay a powerful priest. Of a masked man who saved Yezelnik, then robbed him and stole his powdered wife's heart at the same time. Oh, and then robbed him again in his own castle for no better reason than to witness the foolish expression on his face.
It does seem as if everyone is prying into my past.
Everyone but yourself.
What does that mean?
It means you're forgetting to remember where you came from and how far you walked. It means you're losing your joy and your worry. You see Powry's raiding a coach and take him on, then take on the men in the coach when you're done with the dwarves. You see a high castle wall and decide to climb it for treasures you don't even want. Now there's a man I want to walk beside.
I'm right here.
No. Wish that you were.
They were apart for nearly half an hour, Jameson continuing along the road south.
If I was one of Yezelnik's Burmen, you'd be lying dead in the brush.
Jameson froze at the sound of his own words coming back at him. He slowly turned to regard Branson, sitting easily on a branch, his legs dangling, his mask down over his eyes low enough so that the star-shaped brooch showed clearly on his forehead.
And how did you know to be there instead of up on that rock?
Because I know that you know what your enemies are likely to see and from where they're likely to be watching. They can't see you from there. You were careful to make sure of that.
Good to know that you listen to me, boy.
More than you realize.
Father Malskinner and Brother Honig of the Chapel of Precious Memories entered the keep of Laird Panlimaris somewhat tentatively, expecting an angry berating from a volatile man. Brother Pontius had stopped by the chapel of Palmaristown before his return to Chapel Abel to inform the monks of the stern and defiant message he had just delivered on behalf of Father Artolivan.
Ah, good. I always count on Father Malskinner to be on time.
I trust that your son is well?
Since your church has taken its stand, he had better stay away from Ethelbert's swords.
The brothers would not refuse to care for any man's wounds.
Yes, any man of either side. Under Father Otto Levin, your order has perfected the art of...
neutrality.
Cowardice.
Panlimaris' arm sliced to his side. Immediately, a dozen men dropped their halberds level with the monks and closed in on them in a nearly complete and inescapable circle. The two monks were herded together as sharp bronze spear tips prodded at them.
Laird Panlimaris, I protest.
I expect you would.
What is the meaning of this?
Your father, Otto Levin, has declared opposition to King Yezelnik. So it follows that he has declared his opposition to me, loyal to Yezelnik as I am. If your leader is going to declare war, you would be wise to be better prepared than to walk into your enemy's castle.
I demand that you release us.
The prodding of halberds quickly had the two monks moving toward the room's side door.
Take their gemstones.
I demand you release us to the Chapel of Precious Memories.
Where my guards are even now, collecting the rest of your treasonous band. Your chapel is my chapel now, monk. I will have your inventory of gemstones and all the gold you have taken from the people of Palmaristown these last decades. Your welcome in my domain is at its end.
Brother Fartus had spent many of his days down at the dock section of Palmaristown, and so knew the group of men who walked into the Chapel of Precious Memories. These were the dockmasters, even the harbormaster himself, tough and disciplined and loyal to Laird Panlimaris. They were armed, though they came in with their weapons sheathed, but Fattus felt the hairs on the back of his neck tingle. He alone among the brothers of the Chapel of Precious Memories had been to Chapel Abel in recent months to warn them of the approach of the highwayman, and so he appreciated the gravity of Father Artolivan's declaration, perhaps most of all. He had seen the prisoners of both Ethelbert and Delaval and understood the insanity of King Yezelnik's demand that one group be freed and the other executed. These men and women worked side by side at Chapel Abel. The lines of loyalty had been blurred to nothingness, and not one of them, by Fatus's estimation, would prefer to be sent from Chapel Abel if that meant going back to the front lines of the awful war. Even offering complete freedom and land, Dawson McKeag had been unable to convince more than a handful to sail with him to Vanguard. Thus, King Yezelnik's declaration had been a fool's writ. But for Father Artolivan to make such a bold response as relayed by Brother Pantitius was no small thing. Brother Fartus knew Laird Panlimaris well, too. He had watched the man swell with pride over the last few months as his son scored great victories across the land in the name of King Delaval and now King Yezelnik. Panlimaris remained unwavering in his support for King Yezelnik. These armed loyalists were not in the Chapel of Precious Memories by accident or coincidence, nor was the sudden and unexplained absence of Father Malskinner and Brother Honig a coincidence.
Tell the brothers to quietly slip into the streets.
Fatus spoke to a nearby pair of monks.
Move to the eastern gate with all haste, and with as many gemstones as can be carried.
Brother?
With all haste, and beware the men in the nave.
Laird Panlimaris's men.
Shed your robes and go dressed as common folk. Go now.
Then, recognizing his duty here, accepting his lot as the highest-ranking brother within the chapel, Fatus went to the nave to greet the visitors. Less than half an hour later, Fatus was dropped in chains before Laird Panlamaris's throne. Throughout the rest of the day, he watched as brother after brother, often severely beaten, was brought in and dropped unceremoniously on the floor. The next day, Laird Panlamaris's dungeon swelled with monk prisoners, for only a handful of the fourscore brothers of the Chapel of Precious Memories had managed to escape the city. Jameston Sequin was not a sound sleeper. Living most of his life alone in the wilds of Vanguard and southern Alpinador, the man had trained himself to react to the slightest of sounds or movements. His eyes opened wide this dark night, and he was surprised indeed when he looked to the side to see that Branson's bedroll was empty. The scout lay very still for a few moments, allowing his sensibilities to fully adjust to the darkness. He rolled to his side, tucked and set his foot under him, then rose up tall and gathered his bow and quiver. He heard another sound then, and followed it to a small clearing. Branson stood in the middle of the lee, working his fine sword furiously through a series of practice cuts and blocks, a brilliant dance of perfect balance, which again reminded Jameston of just how good a fighter this young man truly was. Jameston rested the tip of his bow on the ground beside him and leaned on it, enjoying the show. Branson turned in one mock attack to the side and then spun all the way around, looking right at Jameston. Jameston knew that he had been seen, and that confused him and unnerved him more than a little, for the night was not bright. Only a few stars twinkled above, and he was fully engulfed in the darker shadows of a stand of thick spruce. Branson couldn't have seen him from that distance, not viewing from the lighter open lee to the darker shadows. But Branson had seen him. Of that, Jameston was certain. The scout shook his head and continued to watch as Branson finished with a flurry, moving from a series of defensive poses and blocks to a sudden and violent forward movement, sword thrusting. The young man ended by lifting that magnificent blade high to his right. To Jameston's astonishment, the blade erupted in a sudden burst of flames.
How the...
His surprise only heightened as Branson, seeming as surprised as Jameston by the flaming sword, reached over with his free hand and felt the burning blade.
They're not flames, then.
Jameston walked up beside Branson. He reached toward the fiery sword, snatching his hand back immediately. An all-too-real fire danced on the shining metal of that beautifully etched sword blade. Branson looked at him with puzzlement and shrugged.
I never saw your sword do that before. I've never heard of any sword doing that before.
It's not the sword.
Branson pointed to the star set on his forehead. Three of the gems, ruby, serpentine, and the agate, twinkling.
Nice brooch.
I grew up among gemstone users in Chapel Pride. My connection to the stones and their powers is considerable. The cat's eye let me see you as clearly as if you were standing in the midday sunlight.
He looked at his sword as he spoke, and with a thought, winked out the fires, leaving the Silverel blade unscathed.
Full of surprises.
Even to myself.
What else can you do with that toy you get stuck on your head?
I don't know. Yet. But I will find out.
Jameston stared at him for a few moments, then headed to the campsite.
Long walk tomorrow. Not many hours left before we started.
Branson nodded, though Jameston wasn't watching him. The young man didn't immediately follow. Instead, he stood under the stars, staring at his sword, trying to sort out the unexpected benefits the brooch had shown him, and wondering what more might yet come. They were off early in the morning, Jameston setting a swift pace. Signs along the road indicated a village not too far in the distance, and Jameston wanted to get there before they set their next camp.
Maybe we can try out that rid of yours. Or you can just wear the deerskin coat and pants and keep your hat on your head.
No, my clothing suits me. I am Branson the Highwayman. I will not hide who I am. Dame Gwydra says I need not.
The man who calls himself King of Haunts says you do.
I expect that I will have to visit with the man who calls himself King of Haunts, then.
To convince him?
To take his money. To make his wife swoon for no better reason than to see the anger on his face.
Then he wants you dead even more.
Then I'll have to kill him and hope his successor is more reasonable.
Took my advice, did you?
In response, Branson hopped and skipped lightly, landing in an exaggerated heroic pose.
I should thank you.
Oh?
You don't have to do this.
Dame Gwydra is a friend, and she's better served if you learn to keep your head on your shoulders.
This isn't about Dame Gwydra. Not entirely, at least. So thank you for teaching, and most of all, for reminding me.
You do have a way of talking in riddles, boy.
Reminding me to smile, and to enjoy this, as trying as it may be.
Well, what's the point otherwise?
There is none. And so I thank you, Jameson Sequin. Because of you, I have remembered my past, and what I have overcome to get to this point.
Jameson gave an exaggerated deep bow.
I've been in love with Kaydale since I was a boy, you know.
Good taste.
But I never, ever dared believe she could love me in return.
Because you were the broken boy, the stork.
Branson stared at him, but couldn't respond past the lump in his throat.
You figure she loved you after you found a way around that infirmity. So now you doubt that she...
Never. I doubt nothing about Kaydale.
And you shouldn't. Easy enough to see in her eyes. Kaydale loves Branson, not the highwayman. Kaydale's always loved Branson. But she probably wasn't sure that he could ever love her. Could you?
What do you mean?
When you were the stork, could you have loved Kaydale?
I did.
And you would have married her, even if you hadn't found the answer to your problem in the gemstone you wear on your head?
Jameson, of course. I have loved her. No, I would not have let her marry me.
I know. And I know that she wouldn't have let your condition stop her from wanting to marry you. Don't ever let yourself think that you weren't good enough for her, boy. You're still the stork, and he's still you, and Kaydale loves you.
There was a new spring in Branson's step. He was feeling quite good about himself, about the possibilities of the gemstone brooch, and about the woman he had left behind in Chapel Pride. That step did slow as the sun lowered in the west, however, as he and Jameson moved down the cobblestones into the heart of Eskald. They heard the whispers coming at them from every direction as they entered the town. Obviously, the highwayman was known.
You've made quite a name for yourself, boy.
We're not far from Pride Town. And yes, something important happened there, of which I was more than a small part.
They appreciate it.
The pair made their way to the village's common room, where all eyes turned upon them as they took seats at a small round table. The serving girl began to move their way, but the tavern keeper, an older and severe-looking woman with short hair curling tightly to her rather square forehead and a small but tight frame, held the serving girl back and went to see to the guests herself.
You got some belly for walking in here, Open.
A fine day to you, good lady.
It could be.
Would you prefer that we leave?
Makes no never mind to me. Go where you want, but go looking over your shoulder if you got any sense between your ears.
I have a writ of passage from a Hans Laird, lady.
One loyal to Ethelbert or Yezelnik?
I do not really know.
Best be hoping it's Yezelnik and that he's listening. So are you eating or drinking or both?
You would still serve us.
Am I looking like a soldier to ye?
A little bit, yes.
The woman told Jameson of a fine stew and a finer brew, and that seemed like just the thing for the road-weary duo. When she went to get her meal, Jameson kept up the small talk, chattering to Branson about the weather and other nonsense. So out of character was the man a few words, that Branson looked at him strangely.
I thought that squirrel was going to jump down and bite your neck.
Branson's jaw hung open at the gibberish.
What were the two by the door staring at us like that? More than a fairy tale rat can take.
Branson's mouth started to form the question, what, when Jameson's words began to register. He used the hopeful distraction to get a look at the men by the door. That quick glance confirmed Jameson's concern as valid. Grim faces staring intently, too intently. He turned back to Jameson and began talking about a squirrel chasing a skunk, the pair by the door, enough in view out of the corner of his eye for Branson to see them depart.
Trouble.
Do we eat or do we leave?
If you leave, I'll just eat yours too.
Their meal went off quietly. One of the two curious men who had left returned to his previous seat by the door and did a poor job pretending that he wasn't staring at them.
Try not to look too intimidating and we'll have a bit of fun.
The pair passed right near the spy as they exited the tavern. Jameson dipped the tip of his tri-cornered hat to the tavern keeper. Branson tossed a mischievous wink at the seated man.